our medical director at the Memorial Hermann Sugar Land Hospital for Sports Medicine Outreach. And he's the medical director for the Sugar Land Skeeters. I've had a privilege of knowing him since he was in residency. So he's a really good friend of mine. So we're really happy to have Dr. Ray Hall-Bajani out here. And I'll turn it over for him. Should be very quick, lightning fast, hopefully. I know you guys are kind of seeing the light at the end of the tunnel. So yeah, we'll respect that.
Yeah, let's put it in my pocket. Yeah.
Let him get set up, and then we'll turn it over to Doc.
All right. Ready? You guys can hear me? Okay. You guys all awake, right? Tuesday afternoon, second and last speech. All right, so we're going to try to make this as painless as possible. So I've got to talk on updates on sickle cell trait and rhabdomyolysis. I'm going to try to keep this more up for current new theories versus what we already know. So we're going to try to keep this as simple and as fast as possible. I have no financial disclosures to disclose. I don't have anything to discuss as far as money I'm going to make off this, even though if you guys want to leave tips, they can leave them on the stage. Rhabdomyolysis. This is the time of year, right? Rhabdomyolysis. Everyone gets to see it when football camp starts in about a month from now, and everyone loves this 101 degrees weather we're having with 90% humidity after this nasty rainstorm. We all know this lovely pathway. It's there for you guys. I am not going to discuss this because I wanted to make sure that we understood a couple of key components. One, it's the repetitive exercise that overstretches the sarcoplasmic reticulum, causes a whole cascade of events, and causes muscles to break down at an excessively high rate. As a result, you get the enzyme deficiencies, you get the low potassium, and you get the low oxygen, causes your ATP, which is your powerhouse molecule, to go away, and all of a sudden, everything starts going down. Increase your muscle breakdown, causes you to clog up your kidneys, and hence we're in rhabdo. All right, what causes it? So this is something I want to touch on, because from our standpoint, sitting as trainers, we have a lot of things that we can see when it causes this, but the only one we actually see is excessive physical exertion. When you guys see rhabdo for the first time, you know, usually it's due to the heat. And my theory is if you see it for the second time, it's not due to the heat. Something else is causing it, and you need to figure out what is triggering it to happen. Muscle injury, obviously you can have crush injuries, you can have blunt force trauma started off, you can do the excessive physical exertion. Muscle ischemia, decreased blood flow. Occlusion syndromes can also cause this to happen. Temperature changes, we all know about that. We know about the excessive heat in the lovely state of Texas. What we don't know about is the excessive cold, okay? And this is where it gets a little dicey. Excessive cold doesn't have to be below freezing. It has to be a rapid change in temperature, which we love seeing in Texas so much, that can potentially cause an athlete to not be adapted to that temperature change that can cause this to happen. As a result, you can get ischemia and you can get cellular degeneration. Malignant hypothermia and malignant syndrome, medication-based. Right? Medication-based. Certain combinations of medicines cause it. Nowadays, a lot of those medications are not mixed as well as not even be given anymore, but it needs to be aware of. Abnormalities in electrolytes and serum. Chronic low potassium. All right, so this is one that I harp on because guess what? We don't draw labs on our football players, do we? But how many of you guys think that these guys go home and eat enough potassium to come back the next day? They don't. They always live low. What is too low? We don't know. What we do know is that it puts you at risk. So if you have football players that are starting to cramp up, that's a risk. Likely means low potassium. It's a risk to go into rhabdo. Overuse of diuretics. Not much seen in the high school population. In the college population, you might see it. Now it's a banned substance, but it's there. You have to be aware of it. Infections. So the list of these infections are quite bad. But I want you to focus on the first two, staph and pneumo. Early onset pneumonia, skin infections that progress can easily cause you to go into rhabdo. It's there, you need to be aware of it. And obviously you have all your fun toxins. The ones I always stress on are your lovely ones that are in the schools these days, all these lovely drugs that are illegal, as well as the alcohol. Not as common are the insect bites and the stings, but they are there. As far as steroids, corticosteroids that physicians like myself will give time to time for acute inflammation and arthritis and bursitis can also cause you to go into rhabdo, especially if you exert too hard. Endocrine disorders, we're going to skip over genetic and autoimmune disorders, I'm going to touch on for a split second, because a lot of times, once you have that second or third episode of rhabdo on a particular athlete, that might end up being the cause, and it's usually missed until the genetic workup is complete. Okay, NCAA Sports Medicine Handbook this year changed their list of top 10 factors to increase risk. A lot of these are pretty straightforward. A lot of these are the common sense, but I'm going to repeat them anyways. Athletes who tried their hardest means that they tried harder than they're supposed to try. They come in there and say, you know what, this is day one, we're in camp, I'm going to go ahead and push myself without having worked out the week before and do everything I can to make the team without having any kind of warm-up. Guess what? That person's at risk. Workouts are not part of a periodized program in the sense that, okay, once again, kid comes in, summer he's been laying off for 4 weeks, all of a sudden he decides, I'm going to just push myself and work out, go to a SAC camp over the summer and push himself harder than he ever has and not warmed up to it. He's at risk. Novel workouts, meaning that they do something that they've never done before. And they go in there with 100% effort, and they're going to go crush that workout instead of learning the technique and learning the workouts. And then they go, see, right after that, they go rest. So they put their body into hope overdrive, and then they rest. Guess what? Puts you at risk. Irrational, intense workouts intended to punish the athletes. We know our coaches. We know coaches sometimes like to push kids hard, especially if they're trying to beat something into them. Guess what? It's now a risk factor in NCAA, and they're gonna attack this if they see it. Performing exercise to muscle failure, meaning doing squats until they can't do squats anymore. Yeah, how many times have you seen that? Decide, you know what? We're just going to let you guys go until you can't go anymore, no matter what you feel. Put you at risk. Focusing one muscle group. That's a big one. That's not one we deal with much more now because of the fact that we've gotten much better at our workout regimens. But if you do it, it causes a problem. Increasing number of sets and reps means that you are going to, say, do 15 reps, and now next day you can do 20 reps in the exact same time you did those 15 reps the day before. Puts you at risk. Mind the weight without looking at fatigue. Puts you at risk. Kind of makes sense. I'm saying the same stuff over and over again, but it's to a different degree. Okay, we know what it looks like. You come in, patient comes in, the athlete comes in, they have localized muscle pain, they feel weak, they are slightly swollen, they may have some bruising, and they might feel some tenderness, right? You can also have the tea-colored urine. Tea-colored urine is myoglobin. It looks like blood, but it's not blood in the urine. That's what tea-colored urine means. You can get to that point where you get feces, fever, nausea, emesis, confusion, yada, 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 but you should catch it before it gets there. That's the key to the puzzle. Okay, how do you diagnose it? That's how we come in. Physicians come in, we check their labs. Labs show that they have increased muscle enzymes. They may have been spilling urine myoglobin. They might be having increased potassium, increased kidney function. Kidney enzymes cause decreased kidney function. Okay, I will tell you right now, less than 10% of rhabdomyolysis ends up going to kidney failure right now. And the reason that's the case is we catch it early, and that's the point. We need to catch it early before it gets into the kidneys. If it gets into the kidneys once, that second episode is going to cause more damage. So it's not reversible damage in a sense. All this fun stuff that's all in there, that's for what we do as workup. The key is once they're in, they get put in the hospital, they get fluids, and they get everything checked out. They get checked out, and they get flushed out, and then they go back in when they're ready to go back in. How much fluid do we put into these guys? Anyone ever seen a kid with rhabdo in the hospital? Yeah? How much fluids were these guys getting in? Do you remember, by any chance, a day? Yeah. Okay, so your body has 6 liters of fluid, right? These guys are going wide open. These guys might end up getting up to 10 liters of fluids a day to flush their muscles out, as well as keep their kidneys intact. These guys will get 10 liters of fluid a day. Guess how many times they're going to urinate? Maybe once, because they are completely spacing all the fluids into the interstitial space because of the muscles that are broken down. So that's what's the point. Second thing, you put all that fluids in them and you don't put potassium in them, guess what? Potassium drops even more, and now we have life-threatening cardiac issues that we have to worry about. You alternate these fluids. You consider mannitol. Don't use it anymore. Usually we can get away with just giving the fluids. And you can end up going to dialysis for this. I've not seen it. I've read about it. I hope I never see it, because that means that whatever we did wrong. And it doesn't matter who says otherwise. How do you prevent it? Follow the rules. Follow the rules. Follow the rules as far as moderation, working as a team. You know, Brett spoke a few minutes ago about nutrition. I think that's extremely important. Working with your coaches to figure out where these guys' reps max are and where their maximum thresholds for all the different exercises are. And that way, you can make sure that you don't get this kid to a deep end. Make sure you have an EAP plan, because remember, sickle cell and heat stroke can also cause this. And that's what I'm going to transition into. Sickle cell trait. Okay. NCAA over the last 5 years has changed the guidelines twice now. Twice. And they're going to continue to change it because we still don't know how to handle this properly. 2009, this is when it first started. I say it three times because until that point, everything was hunky-dory. You have to have an exam, laboratory exam, saying that this kid has been tested for sickle cell disease and sickle cell trait. Doesn't matter if they say yes or no, you have to be tested. They can decline it, and they can sign a written release. If anyone's ever seen that written release, it's extensively long, has 2 to 3 pages long, basically says that if anything happens to you as a result of unknown sickle cell trait, all parties are not liable. It's a long, kids usually will sign it, but they don't know what they're signing into. History, Division I took it on 2010, and now in last year, in 2014, Division III. So all three divisions of NCAA have now adopted this policy. Here's the funny thing. The American Society of Hematology, which is the big society that deals with sickle cell, opposes this. Do you know why? Anyone know why they oppose this? It was on CNN about a year ago. Anyone remember listening to it? They basically said that you are discriminating against kids that have sickle cell trait. It is not a hindrance to athletic performance. And this is from the American Society of Hematology. It says that that you're going to harm them because you're going to identify them, and then you're going to reduce their workouts and reduce everything as a result when you don't necessarily have to. Proper hydration and proper workout techniques can make them as good as an athlete without sickle cell trait. So guess what? The biggest governing body that deals with sickle cell said no. NCAA said yes. Here are all the organizations that actually said yes. Whole bunch of them. So it's still a conflicted argument. The point I'm trying to make is that it's going to change again, but I need to get you guys updated as far as what we need to see. Is it effective? This is where we get into statistics. And as physicians, as healthcare providers, we need to know if this is cost-effective and does it save lives. You've had one death a year since 2010, before the law came into place, that was due to sickle cell trait. Since then, we've had one known death, and we still don't know if it's truly due to sickle cell trait. So did it reduce? Possibly. What has it done for us? It has allowed us to educate, and train not just the patient, but all of you guys, all the coaches, and the university staff to let them know that we have to be aware of these kids. It also has given extra attention to hydration. So once again, do we know that sickle cell screening itself reduce the number of deaths, or was everything else we did as a result of it reduce the number of deaths? Here's the cost effectiveness. This came from Kim Harmon's group in the University of Washington in Seattle, who's a primary care sports doctor, who's presented at last year's annual sports medicine meeting. All right. How does those numbers look for you guys? Expensive, aren't they? Right? The simple sickle cell test in an African-American for screening cost effectiveness cost $500 per athlete. $500, okay? Look at all athletes, $10,000. And that's the easiest screening test with the lowest yield. The hemoglobin electrophoresis, which is the one that actually will give the actual diagnosis, is nearly triple. This is how much money we spent. How much money we have spent screening sickle cell in 4 years without any startup cost. It's a lot of money. It's a lot of money for in 5 years going from one death a year to going to less than one death in 5 years, not knowing if everything else we implemented as a result caused the reduction in deaths. Okay, so here's the concerns. here's the concerns that American Society of Hematology came up with. One, they're concerned that we might limit the athlete with sickle cell trait. Two, they'll be discriminated against. Of course, there are HIPAA laws, right? HIPAA laws mandate that if a patient's information does not need to be made public, and the patient chooses not to make it public, they have right to not to make it public. This screening test says otherwise. Because the minute this diagnosis is sickle cell, guess what? By NCAA policy that the people that need to know will need to know. It violates the HIPAA law in some legal circles, and this is actually being challenged as we speak in the courts. Do we have enough support, counseling, from a genetic standpoint to go in there? We don't. I can tell you that if I have a positive sickle cell trait athlete in a college setting room, I'm going to end up getting the hematologist on board because I can't provide enough counseling, and so will all you guys. So, and do we have, I mean, we're blessed in the city of Houston to be able to do that on the spot. Some of the smaller towns, they can't. So what's the harm? The harm is, you know, universal precautions, but they're not practical. All the stuff that we do for coaches, you know, tell them to go push hard, play hard, and we are now telling them they can't do it, you're basically discriminating. Okay, sudden death. This is the one thing you're worried about in sickle cell trait. This came from an article by Dr. Loosemore in 2012, basically going through the pathway of how sudden death occurs. Basically, you get low volume, you start getting this early sickling, and it causes changes in your blood oxygen as well as lactic acidosis, increases temperature, dehydrates the red blood cells, and bam, everything starts going to a vicious cycle. Once the cycle starts, it's next to impossible to stop, which is why sickle cell disease athletes don't participate. Sickle cell trait, we just give them oxygen, we let them rest, and we give them hydration and try to reverse the cycle. How do you treat it? It's all about diagnosis. It's all about the diagnosis. Once you make it, you call it, you say it's heat illness is what it normally presents as. You get them, they cramp. Okay, so this is the key differences. They cramp. They're not weak. They don't spasm. They're not hot. They're less than 103 degrees usually Fahrenheit when they sickle cell. They're conscious. They don't black out like heat exhaustion or seizures. They stay awake. They fall to the ground under their own control. They do not just collapse suddenly. It doesn't happen. These guys are in complete control. It's gradual. It's not sudden. It's not rampant. And it's not extreme as far as temperatures and vitals. That's the key we need to be aware of. If it's unconscious, something else is also going on. Usually rhabdo, sudden cardiac arrest, or a heat stroke. May not be just a sickle cell trait issue that we're dealing with. Biggest thing for you guys, you see it, get them out, call EMS, get them out of there as fast as you can. It's simple as that. There's no reason for us to manage this on the sidelines at all. There's nothing, even as a physician and a pro saying that we can do except for give them oxygen and put an IV in that will help them reverse this. They need to be monitored much more closely. You see it, you send it. It's as simple as that. This kind of a come together slide, this has basic, you know, recognition and early treatment stuff for a struggling athlete. You know, the differences between sodium depletion versus heat illness versus sickle cell, and these are just kind of laid out. This is actually from the same paper as Dr. Harmon wrote last year, so I'll pull this diagram out for you guys so you have it to review. It's really easy to mix these three up. It's even easier to treat these three once you know how to recognize it. For the unconscious athlete, you don't have a pulse, you know what to do. You have a pulse and you worry about, you got sickle cell, you worry about rhabdo and you start doing the rhabdo protocol. If the temperature's up, you put them in the heat stroke protocol. Simple, easy stuff. You just need to know the key differences between the three.
What's up, y'all? Host of the Sports Medicine Broadcast, Jeremy Jackson here, reminding you to check out sportshealth.com. Again, sportshealth.com/SMB, sportshealth.com/SMB, where you can enter the November password. The November password is Sarah, S-A-R-A-H. That's my beautiful wife, my number one fan, my biggest supporter. So Sarah, thank you for all the support that you give me. And don't forget, sportshealth.com/SMB, password is Sarah. Check it out. Get your chance to win. Let me know if there's any way I can help you out here on Sports Medicine Broadcast, or if there's any topics you want to cover, anybody you think we should talk to. Thanks.